Welcome to Live Daf, your online Daf Yomi Shir.
Shalom Aleichem and welcome back to today's Daf, Gittin Nun Aleph. We are on Nun Amid Beis towards the bottom. And right in the middle of the discussion, so the Mishnah tells us that when it comes to Achilas Peiros, or Mazoin Isha Ve'abonis, when it comes to these monetary claims, which we're going to explain in a minute, one cannot access Nechasim Meshubadim. He can only take from Nechasim Bnechor. Now, what this means is as follows. Typically, if Reuven lends money to Shimon, Reuven now has a lien on all of Shimon's properties. Should Shimon go and sell one of those properties after having taken out that loan, and he defaults on the loan, he can't pay back, Reuven has a right to collect on those properties even if they are mishubadim, which means even though if they were sold after the loan was taken out. Because his right, his lien supersedes that sale. He's stronger than the buyer. But there are some monetary obligations which can only collect from Nechasim B'nei Chayrun, available assets, free assets, unsold assets in the hands of the one who owes the money. And not Mishubadim. You can't go extract, expropriate properties which were already sold. One of those things is Achilas Peiros. So here we have Reuven stole a field, then sold it to Shimon, who farmed it, who improved it, who grew a beautiful crop, and then the victim of that robbery, the Nigzal, comes and extracts the property from Shimon the buyer. Now Shimon has a shtar with a warranty on the sale. He goes back to Reuven. What did you do? You sold me a stolen property? Pay up! So in terms of the actual sale price, for that he has his plain shtar. He can go and extract even Nechasim Meshubadim, which Reuven had sold after selling this field to Shimon and obligating himself to secure that sale. But when it comes to Achilas Peiros, Shvach Karkois, the add-ons, the produce which was now taken away from Shimon, the added value to the farm which he invested in, all that, although there is a claim against Reuven for that as well, because that's also included in his guarantee and his warranty when he sold the field, but that can only be collected from the chasim which are available and free, as opposed to ones which are purchased from Reuven. The same thing applies to Mazon Isha V'Habonis. A fellow is obligated in terms of his ksuba obligations to provide for his wife and kids. So if he passes away, his wife and daughters can support themselves from his assets, but they can only collect from available assets. They can't go and, extract property that their father sold. Now, the question is, why not? These are obligations. These are dine mumnis claims. Why, when it comes to a loan, can you take from any property, even Mishubadim, but not these? So Ula tells us, Levisha ain't ksuvin. These things aren't actually formally itemized in a document. And therefore, it's unfair for you to go after a buyer who is perhaps unaware of this obligation that his seller has. So typically, the reason why we take Nechasim Mishubadim, it's your fault. Why do you buy property from a person who owes that kind of money, who has a lien on all his properties? You should have been careful, steered clear of properties with a lien. So it's your undoing. But something which isn't clearly stipulated in a document, how could anybody be aware of that? You can't blame the buyer, so you can't go ahead and extract that property. That's Ula's approach. Rabbi Chanina Amar, two lines from the bottom, Anun Amar Beis, Rabbi Chanina Amar, a different reason. Levishayin Ktsuvin. These aren't, set values. They're not exact amounts. They're not predictable. How do you expect anybody to be careful? Anybody who has a wife and kids, it could so happen that it'll end up in this situation. Who owe them the mezainis? So nobody's going to buy anybody property? So commerce will just grind to a halt? I know that he has a $100 loan. I'm careful to leave him that much property to satisfy the potential default on that loan. But something which is not kotzev, doesn't have a defined amount, defined number, such as peiros, such as mazon, ishav abonis, you can't hold the buyer responsible. And that's why it's different. Iboilhu, the Bnei HaYeshiva, asked, L'Rabbi Chanina k'tsuvin u'k'tsuvin bo'i, koin to Rabbi Chanina. So we know it needs to be a set defined number. Does it have to be written in a document as well? So then it becomes, you know, known, and there's a koil, and everybody's aware. Are those two requirements needed? Or perhaps you don't need it to be kasav and ashtar. So, you know, let's say he promised to support his stepdaughter for 5 years. That's a set value, it's a defined amount. Even though it's not actually stipulated in a shtar, perhaps that's enough to hold the buyer responsible and allows you to collect from Yishuv Badim. Tashma, we're going to try to prove one way or the other. Is it katsuv per se or katsuv with katsuv? The Itmar Misha Meis V'Niach Shtei Bonis. A fellow passes away and leaves behind two daughters, Rachel and Leah, Ubain, and a son as well, Reuven. Now, the halacha is, we discussed this in Maseches Ksubos, there's something called Isur Nechasim, a tenth of his estate, which is given to the daughter to prepare for her marriage. So she's about to get married, she takes that amount and uses it for her marriage, you know, expenses. So Rachel got her share of Isur Nechasim. By the time Leah got around to collecting her Isur Nechasim in anticipation of her marriage, you know what happened? Acha Mesa Ben, the son died. So before she got a chance, the son died. So until now, the son was really the Yerush, and he just had to support them, give them their marriage expenses. But once he passes away, now Rachel and Leah are the sole survivors. They divide the estate. They're the Yerushim. So question is, what happens to Leah's Isur Nechasim, which she never really collected yet? Amar Rabbi Yochanan, she lost it. Shnia Vitra, Leah lost it. She forfeited it. Because the whole purpose is to provide for her marriage needs. Well, she now has all she needs. She has half the estate with her sister. She splits it. But Amar Rabbi Chanina, Chanina disagrees. Why should she give up that Isur Nechasim? You know the Chachamim taught us an even greater halacha when it comes to this thing called parnasa, marriage expenses. Mitzila parnasa, ve'matzila mezainus. Although if the son, when he's around, if he sells off properties, not leaving his sisters with enough for their mezainus, they can't go and extract it from the buyers, as we said before, because it doesn't qualify. But parnasa, yeah, they can go and take it out of the buyer. Nechasim u'shabadim. So even when it's sold and given away, they have the right to extract it because of the parnasa claim. But Amr Shnia Vitra, and here in this case, when you have assets available, why would you say Leah gives up her rights? It's here. Of course she should take it. She takes her share of Isur Nechasim, and then whatever's left, they divide as the Yerusha. Rachel got hers. Why shouldn't Leah get hers? End of story. Says the Gemara. What did we just say? That one can collect parnasa, this Isur Nechasim, from Nechasim Shabbatim. For parnasa, this parnasa claim, the Meketz Kaitza, it's a set value, it's a tenth of his assets. Michtav Leksiva, it's not actually recorded in a document. We see that the Kala has a right to extract that from Nechasim Shabbatim. That's a right that all you need is a set amount, even if it's not recorded in a document. No, it says the Gemara Shani, parnasa is totally different than everything else, given this like Kala. It's a famous thing. It's a well-known claim. When the father passes away, everybody knows. All children of marriageable age will collect the parnasa. Come on, the chesiva dummy. We treat it as though it's been written and recorded in a document. And therefore enables her to collect from the chasam shabbatim. But just an ordinary claim, which just doesn't have this notoriety, perhaps you can't collect from the shabbatim, even though it has a set value. Masir Rav Huna Bar Manoach, I'm going to bring a raya to this question. Is it enough to have a defined value, or do you need to be recorded? Mesu. So Rashi explains there's a whole story behind this Mishnah. This fellow married a divorcee who brought along her daughter. So it's his stepdaughter, and he committed to support her for 5 years, the daughter, stepdaughter. A year later, he divorced her. She remarried, went to the next fellow. So the first guy was Reuven, next fellow was Shimon. Once again, he committed again to support her for 5 years. Divorced again. She remarried, went to Levi. Levi has his own, Reuven and Shimon had their own daughters as well, right? So what's the halacha? Mesu, Reuven and Shimon pass away. Their own daughters, their own personal daughters, they also get mezoines, as we said before, it's part of the Tanai Ksuba, but only from available assets. They can't go and pull it out of buyers who purchased from their father. V'hi, but the stepdaughter who got this 5-year commitment, nezoines menuchas meshubadim, she can extract fields which were purchased, which were sold by their stepfather. Why? She's owed like a regular bank. He committed to support them. Bottom line, even though it's not recorded anywhere, it's a verbal commitment. But since it's katsa, it's a 5-year commitment. It's known. It's defined. Buyers beware. You buy at your own risk. So this resolves our question. We see the katsav is the key. No, my skin was speaking b'shukano miyad. They actually made a kinyan with this stepfather. And Rashi says a kinyan is like, it's as though it was written in a shtar, because it's formal. Stam kinyan l'ksiva aymet. The word gets out. Look, he committed. It's as though it was written in a document. So you have the ksiva aspect as well. Well, it says the Gemara, if there was a kinyan, if that's the case, why are we differentiating between the daughters who cannot collect from Mishubadim and the stepdaughter who can? Yachi. Well, b'shekana lezu v'loikana lezu. They made a kinyan for the stepdaughter, not for the daughters. My paska, what leads you to that conclusion? Who says he did it that way? Well, of course, says the Gemara, bas ishta, his stepdaughter, the Hava b'shas kinyan, who was there when he made that commitment upon marriage to their mother, so the kinyan benefits her. But Bita, his own daughter, who was not yet in existence at that point when he married the Isha, she only came to the world later. Who was not there at the point of kinyan, the kinyan doesn't benefit her, so she doesn't really benefit from the kinyan. It's just a regular, ordinary chiyuv that a father has to support his daughter after his death. That's not called kasuv. Therefore, she cannot collect from a shabbat. Well, Mila Askin, who says we're not speaking the Havu Tarayib Shaskinin? Maybe both stepdaughter and daughter were present, were alive when he made his Kinyan obligation. How could his own daughter have been around during his marriage? The Girsha Vahadra. Maybe this was the second time. He took in this woman with the stepdaughter. He divorced her and then retook her. And he already had his own daughter from this woman. So everybody was standing there during that point and he made a Kinyan. So that Kinyan shouldn't help his daughter and stepdaughter. Why would we differentiate? Ella rather says the Gemara Bitoy, the B'tanai Bezn Kochle, his own personal daughter, who's entitled to the Mezonis because of Tanai Bezn. It's a standard obligation that everybody is automatically committed to. So even though he made a Kinyan, it doesn't really help her. She already has that Zuchus because of Tanai Bezn. So the kinyan is irrelevant and doesn't really upgrade her status and her claim. Bas ishte b'ta stepdaughter d'leiv b'shnai bezn kachlo, who doesn't have the schus to be supported from her stepfather because of t'nai bezn. That's not standard fear. It's only because of his personal commitment to her. Mahanin l'kinyan. So his kinyan actually benefits her. And now she's like a regular ba'al aschoy who can collect from mishubadim. V'chir migra gara? What do you mean? If we have both kids here when he makes the kinyan, why would the kinyan help the stepdaughter, not the daughter? If anything, she's worse. She's worse off than the stepdaughters because she has the basis for her claim is Tanai Bezn. So what? Why can't he upgrade that claim by making that kinyan and giving her additional powers? No less than the stepdaughter. Ella rather says the Gemara, you're right. The reason why his own daughter doesn't have that same entitlement is because Bito Ikiva de B'tanai Bezn Ka'achla, because she's entitled based on the T'nai Bezn. There's more reason to believe that he's more meticulous and conscientious in terms of satisfying that claim and that entitlement. Amar perhaps is a concern that sarari, bundles of money, advance payment, atvasa, he gave her before his passing, before his death, to ensure that she'll have what she needs after his passing, because he wants to satisfy that chiyuv bezdin. So just the opposite. Of course, daughter's entitlement is much more powerful and profound than his stepdaughter's. But exactly because of that is a concern that perhaps he already gave her advance payment. Therefore, she has no right to collect from Yishuv Badim. Who says we owe it to you? Maybe you already paid. As opposed to the stepdaughter, there's no concern there. And therefore, when she's coming to collect, she can collect from Yishuv Badim. But it doesn't really resolve our question. We asked whether Katsuv set and defined is enough. Or do you need a Katsuv? Well, here we're speaking that he made a kidney, which is like Katsuv. Tosh Mahe comes right. Omar Ibn Nasan, a Masai. This is going back to that case of the Gazlan who sold a field. Reuben stole a field and sold it to Shimon. Who toiled, who invested, who farmed, improved on the field. He lost the field to the victim of the robbery. He goes back to the seller. Pay up. He pays up. But in terms of the shvach, the fact that he improved the field, that additional value, he can't access nechasa mishubadim. So anything that Reuven sold after selling this stolen field to Shimon, that field is not committed to compensate for the additional shvach, additional value, the improvements that Shimon did to the field. But Amar Rav Nosson, Emosa, when is that so? Bizman shekoda mikhe shel sheni, when the field that the Gazlan sold after selling to Shimon. So let's say we have Reuven the Gazlan who sold his first field, stolen field to Shimon, and then afterwards he sold another personal field to Levi. So koda mikhe shel sheni lishvach shel rishon. That Reuven the Gazlan sold a personal field to Levi before Shimon improved on the field which he bought from Reuven. So now when Levi bought a field from Reuven, he was an unsuspecting victim. He didn't know, he had no idea there's going to be shvach claims on Reuven. Could never happen yet. So he has no right. Shimon has no right to turn to Levi and fall back on him. But let's say it was the opposite. Shimon already had improved on the field prior to Levi buying the second field from Reuven. So now Levi should have been aware. You're buying at your own risk, because Reuven, your seller, is committed to the to secure the sale that he did with Shimon, including the shvach aspect as well. So in this case, we say that if Shimon ends up losing his entire field with the shvach, he can fall back on everything. He can even go to the field that Reuven sold to Levi to compensate for the shvach that he lost. Apparently. It has nothing to do with undefined value, with unwritten commitments. It has to do with one and only one thing sequence. You buy at your own risk, you're responsible. So this is totally, totally inconsistent with Ula's approach, who says it depends if it's written. Rav Chanina's approach depends if it's defined. Here we see a totally new approach. Depends on sequence. He writes, says the Gemara, we have many shitas. Tanoi, Machlokes Tanoim, Desanya. We're going to have a brisa which mentions Ula and Rav Chanina as well. It's all about recorded in a formal document, which makes it known in public. Or it needs to be defined and set, which allows you to be aware and be careful. Desanya, Ein Motzien, Lachilas Peiros, Lashach Kakois, Moz Nishma Abonis. Regarding all these claims, you cannot extract menachasim mishubadim, netikun oilam, v'shein ksuvin. It's unfair. Because these things aren't publicized, these things aren't written in a document. So this is Ula's approach. On Rabbi Yossi, v'chema tikun oilam yesh b'zu. Forget about tikun oilam. Which sounds like you're trying to explain yourself. Oh, nobody's going to want to buy a field if, in fact, you know, even, you know, verbal commitments allow the claimer to come and extract fields. Nothing to you know, no advance notice, no advance warning. That tikkun oilam. Without that, says Rabbi Yossi, yichimah tikkun oilam yesh bezu. V'alo yein ktsuvin. It's It's more than that. All these examples of claims, achilas peiros, etc., they're not set values, not defined. They're unpredictable. So of course, you would never allow somebody to claim, to extract sold properties based on these claims. It's totally unfair. How can anybody be careful? How can anybody take precautions against these claims? These are totally unknown, unpredictable, perpetual claims, and therefore, there's no right to extract nechasim mishabadim. See, we have the two shittas that I mentioned before. What's wrong with these claims? We have these two tanaim. It wasn't formally documented. Or because it's not katsav. Now we have the other pshat, because the sequence is off. Okay. Mishnah concludes with the halacha of hashavas aveda. So you return a basketball. He says, what do you mean? Didn't you find two of them? Why you only give back one? So typically, when a person is moideh b'miktzas, he expresses, you know, partial admission to a claim, he has to make a shvuah, to swear, to authenticate his claim. But not if he's a moitze mitziah. You know, otherwise, nobody's going to want to bother returning lost item, lest he expose himself to all types of accusations and claims. Amar Rabbi Yitzchak, we have an exception to this rule. Reuven approaches Shimon to return a lost item, and Shimon says, one second, Shnei kisen kshurim matzasali. I know for a fact that you found two bundles of money, two wallets, that were tied together. Why only one? They were tied together. Where's the other one? And the other fellow denies. What do you mean? I only found one. Nishba, he has to swear to back up his claim. But shnei shvarim kshurim matzasali. But if he claims, look, you found two shvarim bulls tied together. What happened to the other one? He says, no, it was only one. In this case, Eina Nishba, he doesn't have to swear my timer because his claim isn't really solid. Shvarim menatchim yadali. It's very common for bulls, for animals to just jump away, detach. They're levitic animals. So how would you know that he found them together? Yeah, initially they were tied together, but then they got unraveled. Kisen, but you know, inanimate packages, loyim menatchim yadali, don't unravel. But even by oxen, we can sometimes have a shvuah as well. Shnei shvarim kshurim matzasu. He claims, look, I lost two oxen tied together. You must have found them together. Why are you only returning one? V'alo imer matzasi. The other one says like this. I admit, I found two together. I already returned one to you. Here's the second one. So he's acknowledging the other person's claim. Here is a nishba. He has to make a shvuah. It's Rabbi Yitzchak's chiddush. Ask Gemara, what do you mean? We have the Mishnah. Rabbi Yitzchak lesley, ha-maitzei metziyeh la-yishava, ibn-yitikin o'ilam. Doesn't Rabbi Yitzchak agree with the Mishnah? There's never a shvuah imposed on a maitzei metziyeh. Answer is, it depends. Who da'amak Rabbi ben Yaakov? Rabbi Yitzchak follows Rabbi ben Yaakov, who holds. Maitzei metziyeh is if I'm initiating. I'm offering. Look, here. Look what I found for you. But if you have a claim against me, such as in this case, I know with certainty there were two together. Where are they? Rashi calls it a Tana's Bori. Absolute positive claim. That doesn't really qualify as Maitzei metziyeh. Maitzei metziyeh means, look, I could have just ignored you. I didn't have to conform. You wouldn't have known any better. What do you know about your metziyeh? You have no idea what it was and who found it, right? I'm totally out of the goodness of my heart. It's a total expression of good grace. Not so, says Rabbi Yitzchak, in a case where the loser has a solid claim. I know for a fact, look, there were two together. That's totally different. That's putting the finder on the spot. In this case, the finder would have to make a shvuah to defend himself. Like the son of Lezim Yaakov, pa'amim sha'adam nishba'al tanas atzma. So we have a braisa and a whole long discussion. And ultimately, we're going to conclude that Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov has this view as well, that sometimes, even in Maitim Mitzir, if there's a proper Tana's Bori, so you're right, it's not your typical Tana. I lent you money, where is it? Here you're coming and offering, you found something, but nevertheless, if I have sort of a semi-solid claim against you, that qualifies for a shvua. There are times when a person must swear as a result of his own words. Typically, a shvua comes as a result of a claim presented against me and a partial admission on my part. But here, I am initiating the shvua. Ketzad, how's that? So he goes over to a kid and he says, you know, your father actually, you know, lent me money, or as she learns, he deposited money by me. I already returned half. So he himself is initiating this whole process. I got money, I returned half to partial admission by his own initiative. There goes a shvua. He has to swear to back up his claim. That's an example of a person swearing as a result of his own words. That's Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov. No. Butter. Kudos to him. Give him credit. He's offering the money to begin with. How can you impose a shvua on him? Of course he's potter from shvua. Asks Gemara the same question we asked before. Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov, lastly, Meshav Aveda potter. I mean, Rabbi Elazar doesn't hold of this halacha. Amar Rav, you're right. He's not totally initiating. He's responding to a claim, but not to an ordinary claim of an adult. B'tayne katan, this child is a katan. My father left some money by you. Where is it? Oh yeah, 50% I have. 1 second, says the Gemara. A katan bide mashashi ispe. Who pays heed to the claim of a katan? Matnan. We have a Mishnah Einish boyin altanas cherosh atvikat. One never swears in response to a claim presented by a cherosh shoyte v'katan. My katan, when we say katan, we don't mean an age. He's godly, he's really an adult. But my katan, the katan, why is he called a katan? In terms of his business acumen. In terms of his father's business transactions, katan, who he's relatively a minor, meaning he's not familiar with his father's business dealings. That's what I mean. He's unfamiliar like a katan would be, but really he's a gadol. And he's claiming against this fellow, look, my father gave you money, where is it? Says the Gemara, if that's the case, that he's a gadol tanas atzmai, why is the Mishnah calling it, well, I'm making a shvua because of my own words? Tanas acherim, it's as a result of being claimed against, as a result of the tan of the gadol. Well, tanas acherim is true. Others are claiming against him, but ultimately it's because of his own admission. Well, that's typical, that's standard. Every Moedim Miktas works like that. Kulo Tanos Nami, every Taina is first Tana Sacherim. Your opponent claims against you. Vaidos Atzman, you respond with a partial admission. Vaidos Atzman Innes. Why is this given this interesting, you know, description? Every Shvuah works like that. Ella says the Gemara, and Rashi explains, Ella means like this. No, forget about the Gadol. It was really a Katan. The orphan, the son of this father. Who's claiming against this fellow? Look, my father gave you $100. Where is it? And as Rashi explains, although typically, you don't have to respond to the tan of a katan. That doesn't trigger any shvua. That's when the katan's claiming to have personally deposited that money. But here he's serving as an extension to his father. He says, my father gave you the money. That's a different story. His father actually conducted that transaction. So the katan is just vying for his father, so to speak. He's not initiating a claim. He's coming betanas of it, says Rashi. And that can work. In that case, a shvua can be triggered if, in fact, there's a partial admission in response to that presentation. Oh. And therefore, Blessed Yaakov says, but even though it's just a katan and it's not really a solid claim here, a katan's claim is still not solid as can be. It's like a meshav. It's almost like this fellow is initiating. It's like returning a lost item. Still, since the katan is coming with a tanas bari, an absolute claim, a tanas bari obligates a shvua even by meshav aveda. That's Rabbi Yitzchak's chiddush from before. He's going with Rezum Yaakov. Whereas the chachamim disagree. No. It's just like any other Meshav Aveda, because you can easily deny the katan's claim. You know, you're not really my litigant, I don't know from you. And therefore, he has an easy way out. He can just deny. And the fact that he's allowing himself, the fact that he's admitting, he deserves credit. It's like a Meshav Aveda. It's like returning a lost item. Therefore, there's no Shvua. So let's see inside. Elobah the Rabbah Kamiflagi, and it's based on Rabbah. Dama Rabbah. Rabbah gives us a window into understanding the concept of Moideh B'Miktzas. B'pnei Ma Amra Torah, why is it so that Torah says that a Moideh B'Miktzas Atani Yishav, a person who expresses a partial Hoidah, why does he have to make a Shvua? You would think otherwise. You would think, you know, I'm doing him a favor. I could have just denied it flat. I'm like doing a Shavas Aveda to you. I get credit for it. Why are you imposing a Shvua on me? The answer is, Ein Adam Meis Panav. Lefnei Baal Chayv, a person does not have the guts, the brazenness, to flatly deny a claim of his Baal Chayv. You lent me money. How can I deny? So he said, even by a mafkid, you deposited money. How could I just totally ignore you? A person can't bring himself to that. So therefore, don't give me any. I don't deserve credit for admitting. I couldn't otherwise. And really, this fellow would like to deny everything. The reason why he didn't is because he can't. Not because he didn't want. He couldn't bring himself to it. So that's why really he should make a shvua to satisfy his partial denial, to back up his claim that he only owes partial. So then we have a question to the flip side. Rashi says, well then, if you're accusing him of lying, he's chashud, he's suspected of stealing now. So how could you trust him with a shvua? You shouldn't be imposing a shvua on a liar. So now comes the second part. Really, he wants to admit the whole thing. He would love to if he only has the money for it. The reason why he's not admitting, he's just like wiggling out of it. He's trying to buy some time. So he's thinking, until I get my money, apparently I'll give him everything he deserves. So let me just, you know, stretch it out a bit. That's why he's playing games. He doesn't really mean to steal. And therefore, the Torah says, throw the shvu on him. And that should verify the facts. Impose a shvu on him. This way he'll fully admit to the full amount. So that's the background behind the idea of Moideh B'Miktzas Yishavah. Getting back to our discussion. How does it pertain to the fellow with the katan? Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov Sovar Loishna Boy, Loishna Bebnoi Eina Meis. It doesn't matter whether we're speaking about the actual father who gave him the money or the son who's taking over for the father. He cannot bring himself to deny his claim outright. Therefore, he's not considered a good-hearted man who's just coming to return a lost item. He's compelled. He's being forced to admit, at least partially. He just can't bring himself to deny, totally deny the claim. So although there is an element of Hashavas Aveda, especially if it's a katan here, not the actual person who lent him the money or deposited the money, but since he's coming with a Tanas Bari, don't give this fellow any credit for admitting. And that corresponds with Rabbi Yitzchak before, even a real Meshav Aveda. Where's my other one? I know it's there. Even though there's an element of Hashavas Aveda, but since there's a bari against me, I just can't bring myself to deny it, and I don't get any credit for admitting, and I have to make a shvua. But Rabbanu Savri, Bayud Einem Meis. Rabbanu, hold no. When it comes to a father and a son, I can't flatly deny the actual father's claim against me because he knows the truth. Avu Bibnei, when it comes to his son, you know, I can wiggle out of it. Meis. He can bring himself to deny it, thinking perhaps the kid has no idea, right? Umid Lomay is the fact that he chose not to deny, the fact that he chose to admit, at least partially, Meshu Aveda, who we consider him a big tzaddik. He doing Hashavas Aveda. And we don't impose a shvua in this case, not to discourage people from returning lost items or admitting when they didn't really necessarily feel they have to. Okay, let's summarize today's daf. Typically, a Baal Chayv collects from a Chasam Shabbatim, except where it's unfair to extract from a buyer who perhaps wasn't aware, perhaps wasn't cognizant of the exact details because either it wasn't publicized, It wasn't defined. We have different shittas. One who finds a lost item, and upon returning the item, is accused of pocketing part of the item, or part of the items, the Mishnah says there's no shvur, but Rabbi Yitzchak is machadish, that if the owner has a solid claim, substantiated claim, then we do impose a shvur on the finder, if indeed he's a moedim miktas, and the Gemara concludes, this is in line with Rabbi Yaakov's shita. All the best to you, and hatzlacha rabbah.